to Living Word. Thank you for coming this morning, and I'm glad to be with you. I always try to remind myself this time of the week that not everybody has been here previous sessions, so I am Paul Rohde, campus pastor at Augustana University in Sioux Falls, and a longtime Holden Villager. I think I'm here for the 26th time. We came the first time in 1984. Delight in the kind of conversation that happens here. Absolutely, including this week. You're bringing great questions, and I appreciate that. For those of you who may be here for the first time, for those of you who thought it all went by kind of quickly yesterday, we'll do a little recap. The question we're exploring is, what will shape the future? And I got this question from Dr. Craig Kester at Luther Seminary when I took his course, Genesis to Revelation. And Dr. Kester got to the book of Deuteronomy and said, the question of the book of Deuteronomy is, what will shape the future? And I thought, well, that's my question. I recognized that I had been binging on The World is Changing books and wondering where all of this change is leading and how to be present in any kind of helpful way to it. So we started on Monday with the book of Deuteronomy and focused especially on the great prayer in chapter 6, the Shema, that's part of Judaism's morning prayer. Shema means hear. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. And in that, I feel called, we talked about a call to be attentive to God and to God in the moment and to the kinds of gifts God gives. The context of Deuteronomy is the nation of Israel is about to pass into the promised land, and none of the people who experienced the Exodus or Mount Sinai or most of the wilderness wanderings are going with them. So it's Moses' final word. And we think about the times we face this watershed change as culture, as family, and what do we say to one another and to ourselves about making that move? I recognize Thomas Friedman, which is a book that I'm making generous use of, that increased awareness of globalization and diversity is a huge part of change in the moment. And so we went from Deuteronomy to Joshua, Judges, Ruth, where I think looking at the Bible at 5,000 feet helps us see these kind of macro movements. Joshua is a really tough book to read in the 21st century because he believes that God is on Israel's side, and so they wipe out every city in Canaan and take possession of the land. It's totally us, them. The book of Judges follows that period when Israel was ruled by judges, Deborah, Gideon, you know that crowd. And there's a pattern in the whole book where Israel's in crisis and they cry out to God. God appoints a judge for them, and things get better, and then Israel fails to live up to the vision that God has given. And so the challenge of the book is us, moves from us then. The problem isn't the people around, the problem is within. And then it's that quick, the canon moves from Joshua, Judges, to Ruth, where a foreigner becomes a gift. And we move from that to the book of Acts, where we try to see the same pattern. So if one question is what will shape the future, a second question is, does the Bible help us talk about these changes, help us become aware of how to be present, and so on. We didn't get done yesterday, and so I'm going to start with a couple things I hope to include because they I think they're important pretext for looking at the book of Isaiah and violence today. First of all, I want to go back to some things I wish I had said. You know how that is. I'm in favor of thinking. I really am. But when you've said it out loud in the microphone, and then you go back to your cup of coffee, and it's like, oh, I should have said. So, two of those. When we were talking about Ananias and Sapphira, we talked about the challenge of hypocrisy within the Christian church, that we don't live up to our call or our claim. And I wish I had gone more specific there to say that cuts two ways. We always think about doing things that are inappropriate, that the hypocrite does things that contradicts the conviction, right? But I think the feminist critique, helping us see a breadth of abuses of power, helps us understand that can go another way, which is to say denial of power is also hypocrisy. The failure to act, the failure to do, the failure to believe or to receive that kind of power is a different kind of hypocrisy, and I wanted to make that explicit because I think that'll be really important when we look at Isaiah 1. Second thing is I just made an off-the-cuff comment about salvation and how difficult it is in this moment to talk about salvation because it tends to divide who's in and who's out, the saved and the not saved. It tends to be thought of as a possession. We'll hear people say, we have salvation. And I'll just admit to you that language doesn't make any sense to me. But instead of just critiquing that, I wish that I had also given a positive alternative. Because they think redemption is absolutely central to the faith, central to hope that the brokenness can be turned and life is renewed. This is the faith, that redemptive promise. So some synonyms for salvation that I find more helpful are deliverance or healing. When I used to teach confirmation, when I want to talk about salvation, I want to talk about a movement, that people are moved. So forgiveness is a movement away from sin, or it's a movement away from the impulse to condemn. It's a movement, and to say that we have it without moving is a serious kind of contradiction. So I used to tell my confirmants, a delivered pizza is a moved pizza, right? And I want to say that that delivered people are moved people. And one of the gifts of having listened to the scripture yesterday and this movement from us, them, to us, because I think in some ways it can be seen as linear. The identity development is contrasted with others and then critiqued of self and then finally utterly dependent on the gifts of one's community. So, now accept that, and we can begin. Well, sort of begin, because there are a couple other things I wanted to include. I didn't get a chance to talk about this book. Kenneth Woodward was the religion editor for Newsweek magazine for more than 40 years. And so he's now in his retirement, written this book called Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Ascent of Trump. Fascinating. Retelling of the story. And one of the gifts of it is it just reminds you of some of the really crazy stuff that happens sort of in every era. And when we think we live in a difficult time, I wore my These Are Difficult Times t-shirt yesterday, that is helpful. But one of the insights, as we were thinking about us, them, us, that I thought was really helpful to have in front of us is his observation about the 50s. We Americans can never quite let go of the 1950s. Time and again, we return to that bygone era as if it represents some kind of benchmark by which we can measure how far society has progressed. Race relations, women's rights, gay rights are the usual yardsticks. Or alternately, how far we have declined. Religion, family stability, sexual mores are often most cited. Either way, we continue to revisit the 50s as if through that exercise we might locate where we are today. I think there is some truth in this. And the way, for example, mainline denominations are majorly struggling with us conflict over social justice issues. Women's rights, gay rights, the environment, gun control, all of these issues are pulling us apart. One of the things that this class might be doing is just saying, let's get over the 50s, okay? What the 50s set itself up, I mean, they have the book, you know, that calls that generation of adults the greatest generation. When I read the book, I didn't think the thesis held even in the telling. Because the Watergate was part of that. I mean, all the resignations, Agnew, you know, one after another who resigned in disgrace. And it's like this, they set up Social Security to work basically for that generation. And whether it's going to last for the rest of us is a huge question. So, I don't know, I had great parents. I need to say that. But I don't think they'd say it was the greatest generation. So if you want to get over the 50s, I would recommend a fun book by Stephen King called November 23rd, 1963. And it's part historical fiction, part sci-fi, and kind of a fun read. So the thesis of the book is that a person from the 21st century is sent in a time capsule back to the 1950s to Austin, Texas. And his mission is to stop the assassination of JFK. Okay? I love the Kennedy era, to read about the Kennedys. And so I was, you know, that's what hooked me in. And you get to the, you know, the start of the book, the restaurants are all blue with cigarette smoke. The factories are dumping their waste directly into the rivers and lakes and oceans. And you want to read the book and say, oh, the good old days when people had values. Right. And yet there is this sense that kind of no other era can measure up to this. So I bring this up just because I think the what is left out is a really important question when we get to Isaiah 1. The other thing I wanted to do some yesterday, as we move toward Friday when we're going to talk about hope, maybe I'll come back to some of these slides and talk more about it, but David Brooke spoke at St. Olaf last November. And if you know, though Larry, you have diminished my confidence that it's working. I want to say if you just Google David Brooke, St. Olaf, patriotism, I hope you will get it. The whole address is on the web, and it's well worth listening to. It was called Patriotism, Nationalism, and the Idea of America. And he traces the history of the last half of the 21st century as a movement from institutional community, the way we defined community in that era, by strong institutions, committed ourselves to institutions of education and politics and service, and it was these institutions that helped us understand community. Then he moves into the 60s and 70s and individual expression, because the problem with the institutions is that they left a lot of people out. And so we've got this era of individual expression, and now he's describing the current era as tribalism. And with our talk yesterday about us, them, I wanted us to have that word in the air, because tribalism is hatred of the other based on who they are. So whether their strong identity of self or one's own, the thing you know is what you're against. And honestly, that's not brand new. There are at least decades, maybe centuries, of Lutherans, and the one thing we knew about ourselves is that we weren't Catholic. Right? When we read Isaiah 1, I'm gonna talk about a paragraph that's largely seen as Catholic worship, and we don't do that kind of stuff, and that made us better. And now we're aware of how close we are to Catholics. I mean, But what solidifies the tribe is hatred of the other, and his antidote to that is relationships and thick, and what he calls thick institutions. Fascinating, because if you've gone to Roy Hammerling sessions, he talks about thick time. Brooks talks about thick institutions, which is to say intentionally complex. Fail to get the name of it. The guy who teaches at Northwestern, I learned this at Holden Village, defined community as intention. Jody, can you help me, Sue?
Yeah.
Okay. We have half a brain. So we do. Anyway, Jody Kretzmann. Thank you.
Yeah.
Jody Kretzmann defined community as intentionally complex relationships over time. Thick institutions. I keep referring to this book, but there are a number of people from Minnesota here, so I thought you would love this. If you read this book, you have a hard time in the first 250 pages figuring out what makes it an optimist guide, because it's a very candid telling of the way climate change, technology, and globalization are feeding each other and fueling change at breakneck speeds. So the thesis of the book is that things are changing faster than we can adapt to them, as opposed to the automobile, you know, where we took 70 years to really fully make peace with how the automobile changes. Tomorrow, when we talk about technology, I'm gonna list from his book the number of changes that happened in 2007. Just 12 years ago, he describes it as a watershed moment for a number of reasons, technologically. Where he gets to the hopeful part is that he grew up in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, which is an interesting subculture in the Midwest because it was a community that was about half Lutheran and half Jewish. And somehow they worked together. It was a place that Jews in the post-war era, when the suburbs were being built, felt safety and community and inclusion. And St. Louis Park, standing off this little drum roll, has never in its history defeated a bond issue. Never. It is the location, and this is not accidental, of the Search Institute, which defined 40 developmental assets that young people need in order to have resilience. And I made some copies of them. We're not going to go into it because it isn't even the appointed topic of the day, right? They build assets for kids, but they build assets for the rest of us too. And there are many reasons I love them. I love them because they're concrete, because they're doable, and because they get us thinking beyond the family. Part of the individualism of our culture is that everything is blamed on parents. And I'm just remembering that I was going to start with a moment of reflection. We'll have this moment of reflection next. To invite you to think about a person beyond your family who was in your corner growing up. And who that person was and what that gave you, or what was the first time you met a person, an adult, in your corner. I could go on endlessly about Webster, this remarkable community in northeastern South Dakota, and a former governor of South Dakota who was in my corner because he was the cheering section for the debate team. Does the academic debate team at your high school have a cheering section? It was fabulous. I was not an athlete. I did not have a hope of being an athlete, but I was fiercely competitive, looked surprised. And Judge Anderson was just right there with me. I mean, it was wonderful. So, okay, we'll get to the, yeah, well, we'll just keep moving. I've been wrestling all night, realizing how preposterous it is to think I would take this on in 1 hour. I love the book of Isaiah. I absolutely love it. And here's a holding moment for you. In seminary, I studied what was called Second Isaiah with Dr. Fred Geiser. Fabulous teacher, fabulous person, fabulous human being. 25 years later, Isaac Holden, Dr. Geiser was the Bible study leader, and he was teaching Second Isaiah. So it was, I mean, it was going back to the well. You know, I sat there with my tongue just soaking in the wisdom and the insight. And one of the things that Dr. Geiser said in his sessions is that he had been teaching Isaiah at least once, sometimes twice a year, for his now 30-some years at Luther Seminary. And he said he never went back to the text without seeing something he hadn't seen before. Does the Bible help us tell the story of change? You know what I think about that answer. So what I do want to do to get us into the discussion is, so you hear that the theme for the day is violence. Let's just ask the question, why would a Bible series on change in our day and age include violence? What situations come to mind? Talk to your neighbors about that. Let's get some situations in front of us. What situations come to mind?
Thank you, Sorrento. My name is Violet. What situations come to mind?
Yeah, I'm thinking today.
The question is, why would violence today be included in this series on change? What situations come to mind?
Or why would be
okay. Let's have popcorn them out. What situations come to mind?
Suicide.
Suicide. Thank you.
Sexual violence.
Sexual violence.
The mass killing. Just people want to kill.
The mass killings. School shootings. Police violence. Others?
Road rage.
Ready available weapons.
Readily available weapons.
And the reason people want to immigrate is because it's violent at home often.
Right.
Yeah. Huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The ability of people to post.
Could you say that again, please?
People post killings and suicides and all sorts of things on the internet, and people look at them like crazy.
Yeah.
People want to watch them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's violent acts, but it's also an obsession with violence. I think so.
Pervasive disrespect.
Okay.
News is 24/7 now, just not 30 minutes.
Yeah. And the news is really preoccupied.
Yeah.
I mean, it is back to what you were saying about obsession. You know, there are some statistical analyses that suggest that things are not as violent as they have been at some time, but that there's this preoccupation with it, and certainly it's perceived as way more violent. Okay, just hold all of these, and let's turn to Isaiah 1. So as we're working this early this morning, I changed the number of verses we were going to read, and now I'm going to change it again. I just look at it, and it's like, oh, we can't leave that verse out. We can't leave that verse out. So Isaiah 1, I know the Bibles don't all have the same page number. It is right after the Psalms. We get Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, and then Isaiah, the first of the prophetic books.
It's in the middle.
Yeah, well, it depends on your Bible,
yeah.
You know, if they include the Apocrypha and all of that. Isaiah 1, let's just quickly listen to verses 2 and 3. Hear, O heavens, and listen, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. I reared children and brought them up, but they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner, and the donkey its master's crib. But Israel does not know. My people do not understand. I mean, it becomes a day where everything we've talked about up to this point leads. So here again, what is the focused verb? Hear.
Hear.
Hear this. And that in many ways, the book is a lament of God. So donkeys and asses know who they belong to. But my children do not know me. And know that in Hebrew, the word know is the word for the deepest intimacy. In Genesis, it said, and Adam knew his wife, and she conceived and bore a son. Okay, it's a very intimate. And Israel has rejected their knowing of the Lord. Let's jump over to verse 10, because here we hear it again. Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Listen to the teaching of our God, you people of Gomorrah. What to me is the multitude of your sacrifices, says the Lord. I've had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of goats. When you come to appear before me, who asks this from your hand? Trample my courts no more. Bringing offerings is futile. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath and calling of convocation. I cannot endure solemn assemblies with iniquity. Your new moons and your appointed festivals my soul hates. They become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them. When you stretch out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourselves. Make yourselves clean. Remove the evil of your doings from before my eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Seek justice. Rescue the oppressed. Defend the orphan. Plead for the widow. Come now, let us argue it out, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be like snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall become like wool. If you are willing and obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you shall be devoured by the sword. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Are there any additional situations in our world that come to mind, having heard this many verses from the first chapter? Go ahead.
Coming back, as we know, the last couple of days, to the crisis of the border right now, and orphans, children being held.
Yeah, I first taught this course at a congregation in Sioux Falls last fall, and this is the lesson that is different, because I think because the violence is so obvious. So when I taught it last fall, I said that neglecting children doesn't necessarily feel violent. But now we know the feeling. I mean, we've seen it. And the making orphans of children and then neglecting what they need. But it's some of what I wanted. The Search Institute stuff in front of us and the... I mean, another resource is Miriam Wright Edelman, the founder in the 1990s of the Children's Defense Fund. Her book, The Measure of Our Success, and her assertion that the only way for the world to be good for our children is to see to it that it's good for everybody's children. And we wrestle with why it is that the social justice message has been so hard for the church to get, because the Bible is steeped in it. Well, at least one part of the problem is that the King James Version, which was the Bible until the 1960s when the Revised Standard Version came out, defined the word mishpat, justice in Hebrew, as judgment. So instead of Amos saying, justice will roll down like waters, people heard the Bible saying, judgment will roll down. And all of these texts became about heaven and hell instead of about the earth and about people and community and looking out for each other. So seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. The gift here is that, well, one of the gifts here is that we get this balance between raging criticism, judgment, and formulation of what needs to happen, what we need to do. What then shall we do? And I mean, I love the verse, come now, let us argue it out. Some translations will say, let us reason together, which feels a little more appealing, but I've already told you I was a debater. And so the whole argue it out piece. What else do you hear in the passage? Go ahead.
You're following all the rules, except the part about loving one another. Mm-hmm. We're checking off all the boxes doing the sacrifice.
Going to church, giving our offering, but neglecting what is most needful. Go ahead, Kyle.
Basically, I hear Jesus.
I'm sorry?
I said, I hear Jesus rejecting the religious authorities and focusing us on the poor and the oppressed.
Mm-hmm. Matthew 25. When I was hungry and you did not feed me, I was in prison and you did not visit me. Other observations?
There is some hope.
Pardon?
There is some hope.
Exactly. Though your sins be like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Mm-hmm. There is capacity for redemption here. But you can appreciate why some sense of movement is essential to that hope. You know, it isn't that bloody wool is okay. The washing, the cleansing, and that becomes tangible. I think we've talked about most of this. I'm going to move quickly here. The prophet interprets the present. In some ways, it's a book in three parts. And a great question at the start of the session about when was Genesis written? When was the Bible written? There's a whole school of thought in biblical interpretation called source criticism that identifies that different parts of the Bible are written at different eras. And then redaction criticism about when it is the editor who put them together and what was going on in the world that made the pieces come together in this way. More and more biblical scholars are final form critics, which is saying taking the book at face value, but its historical context is really important. So to answer that question for the book of Isaiah, huge pieces of this book were written down, composed during the Babylonian exile, especially what is sometimes called Second Isaiah. It's 40 to 55. So we've got the critique of Israel before the exile. That's what we're getting into here in chapter 1. And then chapter 40 starts the promise, comfort, comfort, O Jerusalem, is the promise. And then we've got 40 to 55, which speaks to that exilic period, and then Reconstruction is when the people come back. So I see this as a comprehensive kind of interpretation of what was a pivotal event. We cannot overstate the crisis it was when Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed in 587 by Babylon, by Nebuchadnezzar. I graduated from seminary believing that to understand the whole Bible, it was crucial to understand that period. And I mean, we're probably not going to have time to read Lamentations, but Lamentations is the book that records Jerusalem's lament when it was destroyed under Nebuchadnezzar. So a brand new pastor went in my first parish trying to figure out how I was going to get my confirmation kids to remember the name Nebuchadnezzar. So Susan and I were newly married, and the gimmick I came up with was to tell them that if we ever had a boy, I was going to name him Nebuchadnezzar. They were like, really? You know, you would do that to your son. And so then, 3 years later, Susan is pregnant. And, you know, so waiting in suspense. And I, of course, never moved. It's important. The world needs to know this name. Part of this for the whole Bible is that new messianic hope is born in the exilic period. So out of the stump of Jesse, a shoot shall arise. We read that at Christmas for a profound reason. Well, in some sort of perverse way, this may have helped my confirmants' faith, because some of them tell me to this day, they think it's the reason we got three girls. So, never had to call my bluff. I might have done that to my son, but Susan would never have done it to her son. So we're in, you know, we're in the depth of this destruction where it means so descriptive of what you read Lamentations, and women and children are raped on the street, and the blood of pigs is poured on the altar of the temple. It is made an abomination. And so I was trying to figure out what to leave out. And so I've got things all mixed up. What I thought one of the things that Isaiah brings to interpretation, into the interpretation of violence, is a breadth of interpretation. So we've got lament and we've got warning. But even in the midst of that critique, there is hope. Alice heard it there, 7, 9, and 11 are the Advent texts we read. And one of the things that is a beautiful exercise is to read Lamentations, and it says again and again, there is no comfort, there is no comfort, there is no comfort. Then let's just turn to 40, chapter 40, because I don't trust my memory at the moment to do this. Comfort, comfort, my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that she has served her term, that her penalty is paid, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice cries out in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, every mountain and hill be made low. The uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain. Then the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. So there's comfort, there's promise. The word of the Lord will not return empty. Isaiah 55 includes a great passage. Even youths shall faint and grow weary. They shall fall exhausted. Perfect text for a campus pastor. College kids get exhausted. Argument and disputation is a marvelous form. It's our kind of courtroom drama where God calls the nations to be a witness to God's faithfulness. And one of the things, we will come to this at the end, is costly service, sometimes called the servant songs. So I'll say some more about that at the end. Going to go back to give a contemporary kind of application of some of this. Peter Story was president of the Methodist Church in South Africa, now is a professor of the Duke Divinity School. He's got powerful Holden connections. His son, Alan Story, is a Methodist pastor in South Africa, has come here many times to teach. Any of you heard him? Yeah, good. Some people here have heard Alan Story. Peter Story was appointed to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Nelson Mandela in post-apartheid South Africa. Susan and I got to hear him speak in Seattle one fall when we were out here, and the title of his lecture was How Evil Happened in My Country. And he started with an expansive description of white South Africa. And he was part of it. He is white. He had lived in South Africa, a native South African. And he talked about how conscientious South Africans were, following the rules, caring about their families, conscientious at work, seeking to build a constructive, helpful society, very religious, taking their faith very seriously, practicing at every turn, serving, called to be servants, involved, doing these things. He went on and on and on and on. And then he said that when the system of apartheid started to fall apart, white South Africa realized that it was propped up by an oppressive system they did not even see. And it's an upstairs, downstairs kind of thing. If there are Downton Abbey fans in the crowd, you know, the upstairs people are sort of oblivious. But the servants know exactly what's going on. And so here comes this witness from beneath them. He said, we knew almost nothing about the people. And we're supporting our standard of living. But they knew all about us. And then there's this long pause, and he said, do you think what I've just described has any implications for your country?
That's duh.
What do you think? What implications does it have? And how important it is that we've got these models of community, that if we're us them in ways we don't realize and don't know about, that we're willing to become us us, and hear, again, who's been left out, at whose cost this has come, and then find gift in that, ways that the voices we've not heard have in fact profound gifts for us. Comments, questions, go ahead, please.
I think maybe even taking that one step further and saying it, how have we benefited from
it? I missed it, I'm sorry.
So taking it even maybe one step further and saying it, how have we benefited, not just who's been left out and how's that group been, but how have we benefited from
totally. Totally. And how Isaiah 1 speaks to that, to say, to hear God say, I'm sick of that. You know, it is meaningless to me when it's on the backs of vulnerable and oppressed people. Go ahead, please.
I will write on the board later a radio podcast that is a fascinating look at the history of America's white privilege. And it's very accessible, it's very well-spoken and well-documented, and they have a lot of great guests. I'll put it on the whiteboard over there.
Okay, so then I'll just look for... this is another resource that I would want you to know about. It's called genocidewatch.org. It is started by... Gregory Stanton, who is a professor at George Mason University in Washington, D.C. He's a descendant of Elizabeth Cody Stanton, the historic suffragette, okay? So liberation is in his genes. And the mission of his organization, Genocide Watch, is to stop genocide in the world. And so what the organization does is tracks conflict all over the world. And it's described the stages of genocide, which again is some of the language we've already been at. It's classification. Remember we talked yesterday about how slippery is the us-them thinking? And how we'd love to say, well, we are not going to be us-them people. And it totally makes us us-them people to do that, this sort of classification. You'll be interested in knowing that the United States is on the watch list in terms of polarization and denial. Totally denied. There is no heroism in this, but one of my commitments as campus pastor at Augustana has been to go to Pine Ridge, a Native American reservation in our state. It's only 5 hours from Sioux Falls, and I argue with the Global Studies office that I think the trip to Pine Ridge is the most cross-cultural thing we do at Augustana. 5 hours out of town. And one of our sociology professors says, bring your passport, because it's a different world. It is an absolutely different world. And to know how close it is to us, it's in our backyard. But it is a piece of the story we do not know. And, you know, people say, sometimes it feels futile, until the Bible helps me go back to simple words like hear, listen, pay attention, watch, and invite others into the listening. It's huge. One year, it was fascinating. I had 6 students with me. 2 of them were Lutherans from Minnesota. 2 of them were from Norway. And two of them were from South Asia, one from Pakistan, and one from Bangladesh. And we hadn't been there very long, and the student from Bangladesh was looking around, and she said, we have poverty in Bangladesh, but not like this. Well, what a does America not see? Bangladesh, we know Bangladesh is one of the poorest countries in the world. And yet we allow this to happen in our country, to perpetuate, and it doesn't feel like violence, but defend the powerless, speak for the victim. I think even the modest steps of listening, being stopped in our tracks, well, it's the only way I can imagine starting, and I'm grateful that the Bible validates that starting. I was also relieved. I was frankly nervous about the trip because I thought, these international students are going to say, what is it with the United States that you have allowed this to happen? And I would have just had to say mea culpa. I mean, there's no way to defend it or even explain it. But they didn't. Every one of the students took it to the plight of indigenous people in their own countries. So one of the Norwegians said at the end of the week, he said, I would like to help the people of Pine Ridge, but I think I should focus on the Sami. I'm like, God bless you. You know, to build this sort of vision. But Genocide Watch I love this because it again makes it concrete. Go ahead.
I was gonna mention that those of you that don't have a chance to go to Pine Ridge, which I've been there. There's two books written by Kent Nerber, Neither Wolf Nor Dog and the follow-up one, and it's important to read both of them because it shows the whole picture. The first one only really shows half of it.
Yeah, Neither Wolf Nor Dog by Kent Nerber.
Yeah, and I think that's very important. The other thing I wanted to mention is that in those people who have studied the ancient, classical, the Minoan society and the rise and fall of the Greek society, you know, at one point Greece completely disappeared off the face of the earth. And that's when people were very wealthy and they had this dichotomy. Mm-hmm. And that's when they came in with democracy.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Couple of questions about this. You said something about America is on the watch list, and mm-hmm. then you named a couple of areas.
Polarization and denial.
Okay.
I mean, there are. We would probably see other ways we
qualified. Yeah, I was surprised there were just two. Okay. And then my last question is, what does preparation mean in this?
It's preparation for persecution and extermination. So it is, for example, the kind of propaganda that happened in Nazi Germany around the Jews.
Is that preparation?
It should say preparation.
Okay.
Good catch.
Comes in order.
Not necessarily. No.
Okay.
It is not necessarily sequential. They can be happening at the same time. Yeah. Other comments? Other questions? Let's turn to Isaiah 49. Just a second, I'm going to check. Okay, starting with verse 1. Listen to me, O coastlands. Pay attention, you peoples from far away. The Lord called me before I was born. While I was in my mother's womb, he named me. He made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand, he hid me. He made me a polished arrow. In his quiver, he hid me away, and he said to me, you are my servant, Israel, in whom I will be glorified. But I said, I've labored in vain, I've spent my strength for nothing and vanity, yet surely the cause is with the Lord, and my reward is with my God. And now the Lord says, who formed me in the womb to be a servant, to bring Jacob back to him, and that Israel might be gathered to him, for I am honored in the sight of the Lord, and my God has become my strength. He says, is it too light a thing that you should be my servant, to raise up the tribes of Jacob, and to restore the survivors of Israel? I will give you as a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. I thought it was in here. Does somebody know where it is? I apologize for this. That the servant call, there are these four servant songs in the book of Isaiah, and one of them makes reference to Cyrus of Persia, who defeated Babylon. So a non-Jew gets included in the servant of the Lord, and who, the word is actually the anointed. And I will look this up for tomorrow and bring this more precisely. I think as part of the overall interpretation of the book of Isaiah, it's important to hear the service posture. And if we listen to 52 to 53 is the one we probably know the best because we hear it on Good Friday. We need to think very critically about all kinds of assumptions about redemptive violence. So there is that. But there is this humility and vulnerability that is called for both for Israel and through Israel that I think helps us be present to the violence that exists, be present to the change, be present to the oppressed, and lift them up. And I think I will let that be a stopping place unless you have credit, at least a Q&A place. We've got some minutes. Go ahead, Jeff.
The mention of the Methodist Church in South Africa,
right,
and knowing what the United Methodist Church is going through right now, who is the Methodist Church of Africa? Is it largely white? Is it that?
I know that we have some Methodists in the room. Would you be willing to speak to that question?
I can speak a little bit, but not a lot. The Methodist Church has put a lot of effort into Africa outreach in the last many years, and mostly Black African church. And so it's a more conservative church. It's a lot more conservative church, which is partially where we need more dialogue and where there is conflict. So, more information?
Oh, no, I just was, again, in the neglect and the separation and the issues that have just occurred within the
maybe
quote to today, United Methodist Church, have really...
We talked about this question on the porch yesterday when I was up on the porch, and one of the things we said was that the situation the United Methodist Church is facing really helps us out of any romanticism about global work, international work. Because largely we would want to be hugely affirming of the way your denomination has extended itself to relate to people all over the world and to give them power in your denomination.
And to give them power is probably truer, but not a great way to put it.
Right. It's not because that's all that already is a domination thing.
Yes, yeah. It is. And the trouble, of course, is we fall into the trap of us and them. They are more conservative than we are.
Right.
And us and them is what's going to continue to split all of us.
Yeah.
And so we're working, in our mind, toward an invitation toward more dialogue in our congregation. We have French-speaking people who are working closely with French-speaking people in Africa to open more dialogue about what's going on and how it is we work together.
It must be very challenging to have part of you restricting how you want to reach out to the oppressed.
Yeah. And for the Lutherans in the room, in 2009, what our denomination tried to say is that there are is that we would respect bound conscience along the lines of four biblical points of view about homosexuality. But whether that succeeded or not, I mean, at least some of those points of view aren't willing to acknowledge the validity of the other points of view. And that's where it broke down. And, you know, we may not call it a schism, but we lost a lot of people. You know, the dialogue broke down. Go ahead.
Why, you know, neglecting the poor doesn't feel like it. When we see the pictures,
right?
It's nothing but. It's yeah. Terrible. It makes us all cringe. And, you know, why aren't we more engaged with changing that? I don't understand.
Which is the same question that we're asking in the climate change sessions. Why are we not more engaged? Why are we not on the edge of our seats with great urgency? Each of these is utterly urgent. And so I hear you, Dave, and I know you're feeling it, but the truth is we're not feeling it every day. I mean, we're comfortable and willing to hang out.
Back at your slide of the 10 levels of genocide. Gordon Allport has 5, and they're way easier to understand.
Great.
Speak against, avoid, discriminate, attack, exterminate.
Okay.
And so you can hear we're actively in this speak against and moving right down the line.
And that is Gordon who?
Gordon Allport on prejudice.
A-L-P-O-R-T.
Two L's.
Gordon Allport on prejudice. Thank you.
Because when you read this, you can't really, they're it's too theoretical.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for the day. Oh, go ahead. One more comment.
So I was thinking about us and them. You got me thinking about things. And one thing I love about Holden as a parent is how free my kids feel when I'm here. But something I just don't get at home. I don't worry, you know, this is earlier because my kids are older now, but I don't worry because I feel they're in a safe environment, but that happens because it's hard to get here, and you don't have to deal with, you know, homelessness or someone's carrying a gun, you know, so in talking about all that, it's kind of just made me think about where we are here. There's really some comfort and some freedom because we are a selected group.
Yes.
But here we, you know, I don't know, it just took a little, it's challenging to me to add that. So thank you.
It is challenging.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we all feel challenged by how exclusive Holden feels mm-hmm. on some levels. And how to claim and practice the prophetic here so that we've got some practice when we go back down lake. There used to be a sign on the bus that said, the way up is free, the way down is costly. Or the way up is easy, I think it said, and the way down is costly. And there were some people who actually thought it meant they had to pay the bus to go home. But I think there is, you know, it is really profound. You know, I feel so liberated to throw my keys and my billfold in a drawer, my phone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It is absolutely liberating. And I think I would say that with Jesus, certainly as a model of needing that retreat and prayer in order to engage the way we're called to engage. I'm thinking of what you said, Kendra, about never take for granted that people show up. I mean, when you entitle a session Violence, I mean, it is really a great tribute to you that you have come. Thank you. I appreciate that. But I was in parish ministry 20 years before I became a campus pastor, and I kept a decoupage plaque. Remember that beautiful, enduring art form decoupage?
Yeah.
A plaque by my phone that was a quotation by Gunnar Myrdal in the Asian drama A Close With That. He says, When life has proved tougher and more complex than we had imagined, we may be in a mood to value truth very highly. So, go in peace. Thanks for the day.